And welcome to Conversations with the Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Michael Vandenberg, the David Daniels Allen Distinguished Chair of Law at Vanderbilt Law School. He was on campus as part of the law school's speaker exchange and to discuss his research on climate change and the law.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. One of the things you study is how individuals and corporations can make a real difference in climate change that's not just a government issue. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I'm happy to. So that we need to understand that when we think about climate change, many people worry that the actor that can do something about it is government, and that makes them very reluctant to even think that it's happening, that humans are causing climate change. But the only government's not the only actor that can respond. Corporations, households, civic groups, and others can play a very important role in reducing carbon emissions. And so it is possible to have a private governance response. And we have a new book called Beyond Gridlock that's coming out later this year, which explores all the different ways in which private markets and private governance systems can react. And a lot of people, when they hear this, think, well, that must be trivial. But the households in the U.S. account for about a third of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions if you account for the energy you use at home, electricity and other energy, and the energy you use while you're driving your car or otherwise taking personal transport. And you might again say, well, so is that big? But that's equal to all the emissions of all of the countries of South America and Africa combined. So even just a small reduction in the energy use by households in the United States can have a very big impact. Again, corporations play an important role, and the instinct many people have is to assume that the only reason companies might want to respond is if government forces them to. But it turns out in many cases, as we've done our research, that many companies are actually wasting money because they're using more energy than is efficient for them. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is identify numerous situations where if companies were to pursue their own self-interest, simply to try to drive inefficiency out of their energy use, they could reduce carbon emissions by a tremendous amount. And we think that the combination of households and corporations could probably give us about 1 billion tons of carbon emissions reductions each year over the next decade, which is not enough to keep us on the path that the countries committed to in the Paris Agreement last fall, but is enough to help us buy some time.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I know a lot of people feel as individuals and households that whatever I do is a drop in the bucket. Do you have some day-to-day things that you would encourage folks to do?
Absolutely. And what you have to remember is that you can't think of yourself as just a solo actor. It's better to think of yourself along with all the others who are similarly situated to you. And there are some problems out there, and climate change is one of them, when voting is another one. Many of the people listening to this program will vote each time, even though someone might say in the abstract, well, your vote doesn't matter. But of course, if everyone thinks that, then in fact it doesn't. And we once published a paper called The 1% Problem, which is around the idea that we often tend to discount contributions to problems where the contributor is 1% or less. In law, we have this idea of a de minimis contributor, that one that doesn't matter because it's so small, and the cutoff is often 1%. But what happens when you have a problem that's an accumulation of 1% contributors? Then you can't solve the problem if every 1%er drops off. And households can think of themselves that way. And so one way to think about this is, well, what are those places where I could, without a huge new investment, actually save myself some money and contribute to the overall problem? And weatherizing your home is maybe number one on that list. Buying more fuel-efficient heating and cooling systems is another one. Buying a fuel-efficient car is another one. And one that we found from our research is even simply only idling your car for 10 to 30 seconds if you're waiting someplace, if you're at a drive-through line or at the parking lot at a retail store. We asked people in one of the first surveys ever done on this topic, how long do you think you should idle your car if what you want to do is save gas? Mm-hmm. And people think the answer is about 3.5 minutes. And the right answer is between 10 and 30 seconds.
Wow.
And the difference in the U.S., if everyone were to idle their car for only that amount that's in their own interest, they don't even have to be trying to do something good for the world, simply to save themselves money. The difference between idling for 10 to 30 seconds versus for 3.5 minutes is about 600 million gallons of gas a year. So we're talking roughly $1 billion+ a year being wasted because of a myth about idling. So that's just one example, and there are numerous other ones that we're going to discuss in this book.
When you spoke with our faculty is about how people push back against climate change because they believe what they want to believe.
So what the research suggests is that people don't engage in the process that we used to think about years ago of picking lots of different facts and then assembling a worldview from all those facts. That instead, people start with a worldview. They start with an outlook on the world. And this is true whether you're liberal or conservative. And then they go selectively choose those facts that fit the worldview, and they reject ones that don't. We also find that people have something that a team of researchers at Duke called solution aversion, which is that they anticipate what the solution to a problem might be. And if that solution is something that they don't like a big government response, then they're more inclined to reject the idea that the problem exists in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so the work that we are presenting in this new book that's coming out called Beyond Gridlock is to say, isn't there a way to think about the climate problem where a large piece of the solution is private action, not just government action? And that way, if your worldview suggests that you have bigger concerns about big government and liberty and freedom issues, that one approach to this is to say, look, you don't need to reject climate change and what the scientists are saying about it, because part of the answer here is to induce corporations, civic groups, households to save money and do other things by being more efficient about their energy use and by reducing their carbon emissions through private market mechanisms. That's not going to be enough to solve the whole problem, but it is enough to actually buy us some time and to contribute to the solution. And another way to think about this is to think about whether, if you're concerned about whether the climate science is correct or not, why not set up a prediction market, a private prediction market in climate futures, where you and I could buy or sell the likelihood that the climate scientist predictions are correct. Mm-hmm. And the price of that prediction between now and when it matures will tell us whether the market is saying that that information is correct or not. So if you believe in markets and you think markets aggregate information accurately, then let's create a market in private climate predictions. And that's not something government could likely do, but there's no reason why an experimental private market in climate predictions couldn't be put together in the United States. And that would help us get out of this mindset of assuming that it's a liberal versus conservative battle and let the private marketplace tell us something.
It's interesting. When it comes to this aversion to the anticipated reaction, so that may or may not be the real reaction, correct?
So, in other words, what we do is we will first worry about what the solution is, and then that's right, that the solution is actually more complicated than just a big government solution. That could be a part of the puzzle, but there are also people out there like Bob Inglis, the former member of Congress from South Carolina, who's advocating a revenue-neutral carbon tax. That's a situation in which government acts, but where the government action is something that doesn't create a bigger government because it's revenue neutral. The government doesn't actually get more money at the end of the day. It's just taxing carbon and then returning that money back out in another form. So there are a lot of different ways in which we can think about the climate problem that don't produce a big government solution. One is this idea of a revenue neutral carbon tax, and the other is the one that we're presenting in this book, where we look to different ways in which private institutions can reduce their carbon emissions. And often that can occur because often if you have high carbon emissions, it's because you're wasting money. You're wasting energy. You're wasting production. We waste, for example, roughly 40% of all the food produced in the United States. And that is a very important contributor to our carbon footprint as well. So again, I think your point is a good one, which is that when we think about solution aversion, we take it for granted that the solution to climate change is a government response. And our point is not that, again, that government doesn't need to respond, but rather that's not the only way to address the problem, at least in the near term.
Well, so we're here on a college campus, and we want to help people think more broadly. Do you have any suggestions for how to fight this tendency of reinforcing our worldview before getting the facts.
Yes, and again, it's something that affects liberals, conservatives, moderates. We all affect that. I think we have to put a real premium on critical thinking. And I think that when universities serve their function at best, they challenge every idea. They don't let any idea simply sit, and they don't let any idea become an orthodox idea. In other words, one that you simply have to believe. Mm-hmm. So I believe that a function universities historically have played, it's one of the reasons why universities play such an important role in technological innovation, in healthcare, in new efficient legal solutions to problems, is that they don't allow simple thinking to occur without being challenged. And so I think when institutions like the University of Arkansas are at their best, it's because every idea from every quarter is fought over, it's argued about. And what we do, for example, about climate science in my environmental law class at Vanderbilt is I ask the students to find the best skeptics' ideas, and then I bring a physicist into class, and we put the skeptics' ideas up on the board, and we go through them one after another, and we talk about the strengths and weaknesses of each idea. And that's just a good example of how we can say we know skepticism exists out there, but let's play the role that we can play in a university and have an open and constructive dialogue about the support or the lack of support in the scientific community for each one of these different ideas, and let the students make their own minds up.
One of the things we like to talk about on this campus is how professors became professors and how people in the legal profession got into it. Would you tell us a little bit about your path?
I'd be happy to. So I was a zoology major at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the Michael Jordan era. And so I've always been interested in natural systems, and I found during my time there that lawyers seemed to play a really constructive role in coming up with new ideas and in thinking about how to order society. So I was attracted both to natural systems from my zoology major and also to the function that lawyers could play, and went to law school at the University of Virginia and clerked for a judge, and then over time, I have both served in private practice in a large law firm in D.C., in Washington, D.C., and also as the EPA chief of staff. And through that process, I came to realize that many of the things that lawyers are actually doing in the energy and environmental field are not the things that I was taught in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I had a very top-flight environmental professors, but the profession has changed somewhat since I graduated from law school. And what many people in the environmental law profession are doing is getting involved in corporate transactions and securities offerings and supply chain contracts and all kinds of other things that don't fit the traditional model of a government regulatory agency producing a regulation that's then challenged in court and maybe goes all the way to the Supreme Court, Congress enacting laws. These are things that are happening in the private world between private lawyers and businesses, but they have a very important effect on the growth of the energy industry and the ability to reduce the environmental harms that various different businesses can cause. And businesses are regulating each other in any given day. And so my perspective and part of what brought me into teaching was that I felt as though there was a new development that was occurring in law that wasn't reflected in the way legal academics were already thinking about the field. And so I thought I might have something to add in that area. And the other place that I would say was important was that we think about law as commanding behavior. But in the environmental area, we can rarely actually command behavior. If I were to tell you you must go out and drive your car less tomorrow, mm-hmm. my guess is you would come back after me and be pretty unhappy. And so we're not going to do that. But instead, we often try to shift behavior by changing the information you have to make your own choices or by affecting social norms that exist out there. And for example, we don't steal each other's newspapers when they're in front of our houses, to the extent we still read newspapers. And we don't do that because we're afraid we'll get arrested if we do. We do it because we know our neighbors would think differently of us and they wouldn't want to go have us over for dinner or something. And the law has that effect on behavior too. And so a lot of the work that I do involves working with social psychologists to try to think about the influences of law on behavior through information and social norms. And so much of my work is looking at how much of energy and environmental behavior can be shifted in directions that are good for society and good for future generations if we think carefully about how law can change behavior through changing the information sets that people have and the default settings. And the idling example that I've used in prior settings is a good one where people misbelieve, they have myths about how much idling they should engage in to help themselves. Another example is that a study was done by a woman named Shazeen Atari, who's a very effective professor at the University of Indiana, and she found that people underestimate by 40 times how much energy their home clothes dryer uses. And so you get these kinds of problems about how much information people have in various different ways, and that provides an enormous opportunity for the law, without being intrusive or invasive, to give people the information they need to do things that are in their interest and in the common interest as well. And so it was those kinds of opportunities that drew me into becoming a law professor.
So one of the things we run into in the law school quite often are undergraduate students who are hoping to become law students, and they want to know how best to prepare, what to major in, what extracurriculars to, engage in. And I was just wondering if you had any advice for those undergrads.
Sure, I'm happy to give advice. I think there is no one major that is necessary or maybe even best for a law student. I'm not on our admissions committee, so I don't have specifics about how one application gets selected over another, but I teach first-year property classes, so I have 50 to 100 property students every year, every other year, and have a sense of what makes students motivated and successful in the classroom, which I think is something that helps us think about what who should be admitted and who shouldn't and how you should prepare. And I think taking classes that help you learn to think critically is the most important thing you can do. And that could be biology, it could be political science, it could be English, it could be mathematics.
It could be zoology.
It could be zoology, which was my major. And I think that that's the most important thing, is to challenge yourself to think critically. And then beyond that, you would like to learn to write as best you can, and it's very hard to do that. And I think that getting yourself in situations where you have to write over and over again and someone carefully looks at every word that you write is just an extremely valuable experience. So I would recommend that as well. I think that as well, lawyers spend a lot of their time interacting with other people and organizing things and representing clients in a variety of situations. So if you're thinking about extracurricular activities, finding situations where you can help manage other people or be managed by other people and yet help accomplish goals, not just to have something on your resume, which I think is pretty transparent to a lot of admissions officers, but rather to actually roll up your sleeves and get in and actually learn how to manage something and work with other people, get speaking experience if you can. And then for me, I like it when people are looking beyond just themselves. I personally like it when someone comes in and has a passion for something that isn't just made up, but actually cares about the world on some level. Whether you're liberal or conservative, I think going beyond just, gee, what can I get for myself today, to me, makes you a more attractive law student and will make you a better lawyer in the long term.
So who was your favorite teacher as far as learning how to write?
So I had to relearn how to write over and over again, and I think that's true for a lot of people. I worked as a speechwriter for a while and had my writing very carefully reviewed, and I thought by the time I was done with that I was quite good at it. But then I went to law school, and I had a legal writing instructor who, again, had to sort of teach me how to write in a legal way. I then clerked for a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, and once again, he was a wonderful man and a very smart person and a wise man, and he would just mark up my writing something remarkable. After all that, I thought I was by now finally a great writer, and so I go into private practice and find that I once again have to write in a different way. I have to find a way to do what I think the best lawyers do, which is to write in very simple, straightforward ways that are absolutely precise. So I think people often think that if there are lots of whereases and howevers and party of the first parts, that that's good legal writing. But that's actually what appears to be good legal writing. The best legal writing is clear, simple, and straightforward. And it really took me several years in private practice ever after having had all the prior experiences to get to the point where I felt like I could generate something that was clear and to the point and that I could be proud of in that way.
So do you perform the same service to your students? Do you tear up their writing?
I try to. And one of the challenges in law school is that that's very time consuming. Mm-hmm. But I try to give really strong written feedback on student papers and when I have summer research assistants and things of that nature. And I really love it when a student will say, talk to me about my writing, not just the substantive output of my product. And when it seems to me that they care a lot about it, that means a great deal to me. So the most important thing you can do if you're listening to this and you're thinking about going to law school is to care about every word that you write. Start that as an undergraduate. If you do that as an undergraduate, you'll have a real leg up by the time you get to law school. And then don't be worried about taking criticism. There is no good writer that I know of who didn't respond well to criticism.
That's great advice. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Music for Conversations with the Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. For more information and additional podcasts, go to kuaf.com or law.uark.edu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, on Stitcher, or with your favorite podcast app. Follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.